Thanks for listening to the Catalyst Church podcast. We exist to help people find and follow Jesus, and we trust that this message will help you do just that. If God has been using our ministry in your life, would you consider partnering with us in a few ways? First, follow us on social media to stay up to date on all we have going on at Catalyst Woodland. Second, we have found that positive reviews on Google or Facebook go a long way in how their algorithms choose who to promote online. Would you take some time and leave us a review on those platforms? It's amazing how just a few minutes of time can translate to such a huge impact when people are looking for a church. Again, thanks for listening in, and we hope you enjoy today's message.
I hope you've had a good summer so far, have done some fun things, get out with your family. Yesterday, we decided to go out and do something fun because our kids had completed some work over the summer because, yes, in the VP household, our kids do homework over the summer. That is how that goes, and we will pay for their counseling later. But they completed 4 weeks of their reading assignments and all the things that we have for them. That is purely just to make you think that I'm a better parent than I actually am. But they completed it, and so we said, what do you want to do? They said, we want to go to Six Flags. All right, fine, we'll go to Six Flags. So we went to Six Flags, and so yesterday, remarkably, there's like nobody at Six Flags over the 4th of July weekend. Anytime they do a promo, like buy one, get one free, you know they're trying to attract people. It means there's no one there, so go. So we went, and we had a pretty good time, but from the moment we walked in, my kids saw the big rides and were like, nope. And I'm like, then why are we here? And so we spent a lot of time in this like little Toon Village thing doing all these little rides, and it was super lame. And so I was making several comments to my kids, you know, like those backhanded, like, oh man, like if you were cooler, you'd do that. And my wife's like, knock it off. And I'm like, well, I can try. And so as we were walking on, here's just a fun picture that I want to show you for no reason other than that's a grown man dressed up as Batman who's asleep on a park bench. I saw him he was asleep for a long time, enough for me to take the picture. My wife also didn't like that I took his picture. But anyway, I'm like, there's a grown man. And at least he put it up and it had a cape and the whole thing, and he had gloves. And anyway, so we're walking along doing the thing, and then my son, my oldest, Aiden, he's almost 10, he goes, Dad, I want to go on a big ride. I'm like, I don't know about that. He's like, no, seriously, Dad. I'm like, well, okay. What do you want to go on? He's like, well, I don't want to go upside down. Said, that's fair. That's fine. He said, and I don't want to do like big loops and spins and stuff, but I want to go on more than like, you know, this Tweeny Town ride. And I'm like, okay. Now, mind you, I've never done Six Flags before. So I say to him, well, we can go on the Joker. And I was like, yeah, man, look at it. It's just like this wooden thing and like goes around. It's not that bad. He goes, it doesn't go upside down. Absolutely not. So we get in line and he's getting kind of amped up, but he's freaked out, like legitimately freaked out. And so we get to the front of the line and I snap this pic. That's why he still had respect for me, and he still loved me and still called me dad, right in this moment. And so we're getting ready to get on the ride, and so we finally get in, and we sit down, and he goes, Dad, this is a pretty intense like lap thing. Like, why would they do this? And I'm thinking, uh-oh, like, I should have read up on this ride before I made all these promises. And he looks at me, Dad, I'm scared. And then in that moment, that's the moment where you go, son, like, and you give some like Braveheart speech, except I go, me too, buddy. And he goes, what? So I'm like, I don't know. And so I look at him, I'm like, bud, I don't know what's about to happen. Like this, but this is going to be great. All right. And he's like, So, I mean, he is at this point terrified. I am also terrified because I don't do the big coasters that I just made this promise. So we head off, and if you know anything about, how many of you have been on this ride? Okay, only a couple of you. All right, so it starts off, and I'm going straight down. It makes a turn. You know what it does right after the first turn? Upside down. And all I hear is this voice next to me going, no! Screaming the whole 2 minutes, no! We come to an end. I wish I could describe for you the look on my son's face of disappointment, of anger. He looks at me and he goes, you lied to me. And I said, okay, son, lying would mean that I knew what we were going to do. And he says, well, you should have. You're the dad and that's your job. And I said, yeah, you got me there. That's on me. I'm so sorry. So he is like riding that line between seething pissed and like, I want to cry because I'm terrified at what just happened. And so we're just waiting to get off. And we're waiting, and he's just like, just so many emotions going on inside that 9-year-old body. And we get to the end, and I was like, well, buddy, I'm trying everything I can do to like rescue this moment, especially before he sees his mother. And so we're like walking, and I'm like, buddy, that was awesome, right? Like, so cool. Like, you're a big boy. And like trying, and he's just like, stop, dad. I'm like, okay, all right, I'm sorry. And so we get over, and so he runs up to his mom. He goes, there were barrel rolls, and he said I wasn't going to go upside down. And she's just looking at me like, I'm so disappointed. I know. And then we get a few feet past, we're walking away, and he just stops. And he goes, Dad, what? What now? He goes, that was awesome. And I'm like, yeah, it was. He's like, let's go again. I'm like, okay. So I was able to like transition my son, so now he loves roller coasters, and I've created a monster, is what happened. But it was so fascinating just to watch, and you could almost it was one of those moments where you could actually put your finger on when he shifted. When he went from this scared little boy who was terrified to this little man who was like, bring it, the next rock. So then he starts going, what's that one? And I'm like, that one's Kong. Let's go. Oh, my Lord. So we're all over the place. And you could actually see a shift in his life. And I think there's been some points in my life where I know that you can actually put a finger on it. You'd actually put a date on it. You could actually put a time, or maybe even broader back, a season of like, man, this is when it shifted. This is when things turned. Maybe for you, it was when you were in college and you're like, man, I don't know where I'm going to go. No, this is going to be my life trajectory. Or when you just met that person, or you had that kid, or you made that decision and that career move, and you made that sizable shift that you can look back in your life and go, you know what? That was the point when everything changed. That was the moment when everything became different. That was the moment in time when it went from here to over here. And today we're going to look in the book of Acts in a moment in time where that happened for someone significant. If you've been around the church for any length of time, you've probably heard the name of the Apostle Paul. But as we throw back in this series and look over the book of Acts and see how we all got started, we not only are going to see the beginning of the church as we have, but we're going to see the start of individuals. And this is the beginning story, the origin story of what I personally believe to be, and I know this is a big statement, but what I personally believe to be one of the most significant, if not the most significant events outside of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus in human history. Why? Because it lends a tremendous amount of credibility to Jesus, a tremendous amount of credibility to the Bible, a tremendous amount of credibility to the gospel, because while there are a couple extra biblical sources that talk about Jesus, there are a ton of extra biblical sources that talk about Paul. A lot of people knew Paul. A lot of people knew Saul. Saul and Paul, same person, we'll talk about that in a minute. But he was written about in a very prolific way because he had a very large stamp upon history, not only before he met Jesus, but certainly after. And the shift happens here in Acts chapter 9. And so we're going to poke around a bit. I need to read a few verses before that, before we get up to Acts chapter 9. But before we dive in, let's pray, and then we'll see what God has to teach us through the life and life transformation of this man, Saul. Heavenly Father, God, we thank you so much for these moments where we can gather to hear more about you and more about what life is like with you. Jesus, we thank you for the life and ministry of Paul and what it has to teach us ultimately about you and who you are and how you see us and view us and care for us. It's in your name we pray. Amen. All right, I totally forgot to say this, so I will tell them my order is a bit different here than it is there, so good luck. All right, here we go. I completely changed it at 5:30 this morning. All right, so sometimes that's how it goes. As a pastor, you have a message, and then you wake up, and you have a different one. So that's how it goes sometimes. So we first meet Saul in Acts chapter 7. Now, we didn't have time to go through Acts chapter 7, but I just want to summarize it for you really quickly. There's this man named Stephen, and he was one of the first leaders of the local church, and so he gets very bold about the name of Jesus, and there is a group of people, which we'll see, of which Saul is a part of, that don't really like that. They don't believe in Jesus. They don't think he was there for the reasons that he said he was as the Messiah. They want to stick as strictly as they can to the Jewish law and just kind of be very religious and very legalistic about it. And this whole Jesus movement is not that. So they don't like that. And then they're trying to rid it. So Stephen goes before this council and they give him an opportunity to say why he's doing what he's doing. And they say, so what do you have to say for yourself? And Stephen takes that unique opportunity just to talk about Jesus. And if you don't really know, if I'm going to throw back to last week, if you don't know the story arc of Jesus and you want a great example of it, just go to Acts chapter 7 and you'll see how Stephen does it. It's remarkable how he does it. And so Stephen uses this moment to basically fend for himself and give an explanation as to why he's talking about Jesus. And so he just tells about Jesus, and they don't like that. And so we get to Acts chapter 7, verse 58, and we see our first glimpse of this man named Saul. So they being this group of religious elite, they cast him out of the city and they stoned him, they killed him. And the witnesses laid down their garments at the feet of a young man named Saul. This is the first that we see of this man named Saul, who will eventually be the apostle Paul. Saul, the reason it's significant and why they put his name in there is because, say a young man meaning probably early to mid 30s is what young is there. And so these witnesses, or this firing squad, this stoning squad, they needed a little extra in the arm to make sure that they really laid it on Stephen. And so they took their garments off because, you know, you need to get the full rotator cuff into it. And so they all took their garments off to prepare to stone. And when they did, they laid those garments at the feet of their leader, Saul. And so he's not just an individual who's a part of this organization. He is one of their leaders. He is the elite of the elite. He is leading this movement to rid the world of Jesus followers. So then we jump down to Acts chapter 9. We get into our segment 9, verse 1. If you don't have a Bible, you can go ahead and grab one at either exit, or they will be on the screen to my left and right, or you can just open on any app or in a Bible you have yourself. But Acts chapter 9, verse 1. Are we ready? All right, let's do it. Verse 1, but Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, or Christians, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. So Stephen was the first, and there's going to be more. And he is intent on going all throughout the region in ridding the world of Christ followers. He's basically a Christian bounty hunter is what he is. And so he's gone to the leaders, the high priest, and asked for letters to the synagogue, meaning basically warrants or permission slips to go all around the region and go house to house to house and take men and women and drag them out of their homes, bind them, and drag them back to Jerusalem so that they could suffer the same fate that Stephen did. He is pissed. But at the same, in the same way, he also thinks he's completely in the right. He believes that he is doing this to defend God. That there is this weird Jesus element that is around that no one can quite explain, that people are getting really worked up about, and he wants to rid it. The other reason why I believe that this is one of the most significant events in not just history, but in Christian history, is that if the Apostle Paul or if Saul isn't stopped, the church doesn't get off the ground. If he continues to do what he's doing, he will go through every single home and kill everyone who professes Jesus, and it is over. It is done. So as we go through the scriptures, I don't have time to go through all the verses, but I want to give you just a few things because it's important to know who Saul was. Because before we can know who he came to be, it's important to know who he was. And so there's just four things about him that I want to just touch on very briefly about who this man was. The first thing was that he was privileged. He was a very privileged individual. And what I mean by that is he was born in a Jewish home, but he was born in Rome. And so he had this very unique status, which only less than 1% did, of dual citizenship. That he was under the Jewish law, but then he was also a Roman citizen. And so the unique thing about that is it gave him incredible leverage to really do whatever he wanted to do. He could go anywhere, and the religious elite couldn't persecute him, neither could Rome. And so he could go anywhere he wanted to go. And so he utilized that in the beginning to get about 150-mile radius for which to go and hunt Christians. The second thing is that he was incredibly relentless. He was absolutely relentless. We see this all throughout the beginning stages through Acts chapter 7 and 8, is that he had this insane commitment to root out this Jesus thing, this way thing, this Christianity thing. He didn't want anyone to hear about Jesus, and he was so intent on it that he was leading this group of men to go house to house to house to drag people to their death. Absolutely relentless. Number three, he was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. We read in Galatians that he studied under this man named Gamaliel, who was arguably the smartest theologian, philosopher to live at that time. Saul, also known as Saul of Tarsus. Tarsus was the world leader in education. And everyone knew that anyone elite coming out of Tarsus was pretty much the smartest person ever. It was well documented that he had memorized most of the Old Testament. I mean, just think about that for a minute. He memorized the vast majority of the Old Testament. He could recite it back to you. Most of us struggle to remember like 5, maybe 10 verses. He knew, could memorize, could just recite the vast majority of the Old Testament. Scholars debate, as you read all throughout different writings and other extra biblical writings, how many languages he knew. It's around 5 or 6 languages that he knew. Saul was brilliant. Not just in that time, I'm sure if you were to meet him today, if we were to have him here among us, it would be instantly obvious that he was just a notch above everyone else. Have you ever met someone like that? You just get in the room with them. I've had the privilege twice of being around pastors that are just like, you hear them speak and you're like, wow. So I was with this one pastor. It's a very, very famous pastor. And for whatever reason, I got invited to a lunch with him. And it was interesting how we were all just kind of playing second fiddle to his mind. And so the first time he let us know that was, and not like overtly, just it was very sly. Someone was like, there's a verse in, what is it? Let's think. It's in Exodus. There's the story of, and then they give like 2 obscure facts and he goes, Exodus 9:13. And everyone at the table's like, what? That was weird. That happened 5 times where all these pastors in the room were like, oh, hold on, there's that verse. Oh, gosh, Philippians, the thing. It says, I know how it starts. He goes, oh, yeah, Philippians 4:8. Yep. Oh, yeah, Exodus. Any book, anywhere, you just give him like an idea of what you're talking about. He could just give you back. And then one smart person decided to try and check him. Like, really? Let me see. Oh, you're absolutely right. And then that stopped, and we realized he was just brilliant. Saul would be the same way. Knows way more than we could ever dream. And then the last thing, and this is significant, is he was single. We don't know if he was ever married or divorced or widowed. We don't believe so, because by the time we meet him here, he's very clearly single. There's no reference to him ever being married in any book, anywhere. He was clearly unmarried, at least at this point. But much of his life and much of what he went through and much of what he endured alone. And that is very significant, as we'll see in a bit. So, this man, this Saul, who is intent on murdering Christians and putting to rest and stopping this Jesus movement, has a unique encounter. Verse 3. The story continues. Now, as he went on his way, he approached Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven shone around him. And falling to the ground, he heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he said, who are you, Lord? And he said, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. See, he knew it was some kind of godly element. And so it doesn't translate it exactly, but basically what he says, who, God, is this God? God, are you speaking to me, God? And he said, yes, I am. But in the person, Jesus, the person who you are persecuting, the person who you are going door to door saying, don't follow him. It's me. I'm the one who's here talking to you. He gives him a new command. Rise and enter the city and you will be told what to do. The men who were traveling with him stood speechless, hearing the voice, but seeing no one. Saul rose from the ground, and although his eyes were opened, he saw nothing. He was blind. So they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. And for 3 days he was without sight and neither ate nor drank. Saul has this roadside encounter with Jesus, and Jesus makes him blind, a physical representation of his spiritual condition, that he's blind, that he doesn't understand what he's doing, where he's going. And it's interesting that he notes that he didn't eat or drink for 3 days. I don't know if you've ever been there. I have. Where you have such a significant life event that you almost forget to eat. Maybe you've had like the death of a loved one and you don't eat for a while. And it's not because you're intent on it. Like, no, I'm not going to eat. You just kind of forget. You just don't. Like you are so affected, you are so caught up, you are so overwhelmed, you are so just completely captivated by whatever that event was, you just forget. And that's what happens to Saul. And so these men, basically his secret service, his armed guards, who are as astounded as he was, because they don't see anything, they just hear this voice and are watching their amazing leader fall to the ground to become blind. And they're like, oh, this is really strange. So they bring him back into Damascus. And in the verses that follow, he meets up with this man. His eyes are restored. His life, in that regard, physically is restored. And then we see the change that happens. Second half of verse 19. For some days he was with the disciples at Damascus. I wish they would say more about that. That's the only reference to his interaction with the disciples once he went from Saul to the Apostle Paul. Could you imagine that? For 3 days and a few days after, when he's sitting around with the men that followed Jesus and are like, hey, so I hear you want to kill me. Yep, not anymore. How are you? I'm good. You? Like, it must have been so awkward and so uncomfortable. Because this is the guy who was heading, and we'll see in a minute, he is intent on killing Christians. And I guarantee you, in that region, everyone knew. watch out. If Saul shows up, there's going to be some serious problems. And there he is, wining and dining with the apostles, sitting there with the disciples, sitting with these men that lived with Jesus. And immediately, he proclaimed Jesus in the synagogue, saying, "He is the Son of God." And all who heard him were amazed and said, "Is this not the guy who made havoc in Jerusalem of those who called upon this name? And has he not come here for this purpose, to bring them bound before the chief priests?" But Saul increased all the more in strength and confounded the Jews who lived in Damascus by proving that Jesus was the Christ. They can't believe it. They can't believe it. This guy, who everyone knew was on a mission to drag men, women, and children out of their homes to go kill them, is now the one standing on the stage in church going, "Jesus, let me tell you about him." Could you just imagine? Think of like the biggest threat you could possibly imagine to your way of life and to Christianity as we know it, standing on the stage proclaiming Jesus. And everyone would be like, "Who's the guest speaker? Saul? You, time out. You mean the guy who's here to kill me? He's preaching about Jesus." "Yeah, I don't know. I talked to him." Like, you could probably imagine that it would take, I don't know, a couple weeks to warm up to be like, "Okay." He's like, "No, man, like, it's cool. Like, just join me in the back in the dark. We'll go take communion." Like, "No, I'm not going anywhere with you. Like, I want to watch you. I want to see." And every time someone doubted him, it just emboldened him more. Like, "No, you don't understand. I met Jesus." And here's the thing, and here's just where I want to sit and land for the rest of our moments together, because I think in a time like this, one of the things that can so easily happen in a message or a story like this is to look at the life of Saul and say, "Okay, well, what do we learn about Saul and how he moved to Paul, and let's be more like Paul and be bold in our faith." And we end up talking and elevating this man and having everyone replicate what he did rather than who he met. And so I want to focus on Jesus and some of the things that we learn, because we learn a lot about Jesus in this interaction. In this short interaction, we learn many of the things that we need to know about Jesus going forward. And so there are four things that we learn about Jesus. I have no idea how many of these you have, okay? So we'll just go. I have four, so I think you only have two, maybe three. You have three. Okay, there we go. So, cool. I got it. Number one, Jesus pursued us before we ever think or begin to pursue him. At no point is Saul heading out on a spiritual quest or journey to find Jesus. And it's so interesting how we, even in the church today, we even talk about Jesus. Like, I hope that I will find him, that I will meet him, that I will invite him into my heart, that as if it is something that is completely contained upon us. Realize that at no time was Saul ever looking for Jesus, but Jesus was always looking for him. Before time began, Jesus set out a mission to find him, to love him, to pursue him, to show him exactly what he had for him. And it's the same with you and I. We think so often that we need to go find Jesus when all along he is waiting to be found, because he's standing right there. He has already pursued us. He made the first step. He moved first. He is the one who has moved heaven and earth to be with us. He went first. Number two is Jesus answers prayer. If you go back to Acts chapter 7, Stephen, before he is killed, he ends up praying for everybody. And what he prays is that they would be forgiven and that they would ultimately put their faith in Jesus Christ. Where did he learn that? From Jesus himself. On the cross, Jesus prays something very similar. Stephen channels that same kind of prayer, and before he dies, prays for everyone standing in front of him that they would all one day come to know Jesus, the chief of whom, who's standing right in front of him, is Saul. And he prays for him in that moment. Little does he know that not too much longer after that event, that Saul will actually meet Jesus. His prayer is answered. One of the things that I would ask you is, what's the one thing that you stopped praying for? I think so often in life we have these big things that we're praying for. Maybe it's people, maybe it's an event, maybe it's a circumstance, or whatever it may be that we're praying for. Then we just don't see anything because our timeline is so much shorter, isn't it? Like we want to pray and then tomorrow. Maybe by the way, you know what? That's not fair. I'll give them till next Sunday, okay? I'll pray and then, but by next Sunday, I better see some work. I better see some evidence because God's not God if he can't make stuff happen between Sunday to Sunday. And then after a couple Sundays go by, another Sunday goes by, we get that. You know what? And then we just stop. And then we have, oh yeah, I used to pray for that. We wouldn't say that it that way, but we know it. That person comes to mind, that circumstance or event comes to mind, and we've moved on. Stephen's prayer reminds us that Jesus answers prayer when Jesus is ready to answer prayer, not when you are begging for it to happen. Don't stop. What have you stopped praying for? I encourage you, keep praying for it. Don't stop. The third is that he saves by grace alone. You know what God didn't do? God didn't go, oh, Jesus, I don't know what we're going to do here. Because Saul, he hasn't been living right. He hasn't, as a matter of fact, he's trying to kill us. So I don't know what we're going to do. How are we going to make this happen? That they're not waiting on him for anything. They're not waiting on Saul to change his mind. They're not waiting on Saul to stop. They buck him off the horse and he falls deeply in love with Jesus. There's nothing that Saul did. In fact, quite the opposite. He was actually intent on ending this movement. And Jesus came and saved him and showed him what it is to actually live for something far bigger than himself and offer forgiveness and grace and mercy and love. When he, by all accounts, did not deserve it. And we are the same way. It's one of the things I hear all the time. People, why not living a certain way? Well, I'm not doing that. Or when we look on someone else and say, well, you know, they haven't done this or they haven't done that. And we forget that the only way that we experience the forgiveness of Jesus is through grace and grace alone. And then the last one, which they don't have, is that he can redeem any story. He can redeem any story. It doesn't matter what story you are living right now. It doesn't matter what your mom or your brother, sister, your friend, your neighbor, your coworker, and you're like, man, they are so far off the rails. He can redeem all of it, any story. You guys don't have to follow this. I'm just going to rip these off. Cool? So, because if you look back and see all the things that he was doing, all the things that made him Saul, made him that angry guy running around trying to kill Christians, he redeemed every single bit of it. His citizenship, he redeemed it. Why? Because now Saul, the man who had a 150-mile stretch of land that he was trying to go murder Christians, he took that same ability for him to be under Jewish law and have Roman citizenship and set him free all throughout the countryside to proclaim the gospel. No one could touch Paul. There's even multiple times when you see throughout his letters, he gets in prison and the first thing he says is, are you sure you want to imprison a Roman citizen? And they say, well, you're a Roman citizen. We thought you were one of those Jews who converted over to Christianity and now you're preaching that Jesus thing. I am. And you're a Roman citizen. I am. And said, okay, then we have to let you go. And they let him go. So the very thing that he was intent on using to destroy Jesus, Jesus reused to put out his name as far as he possibly could. His resilient and relentless nature. Man, Jesus redeemed that. Why? Because now you have this guy who has no job. I mean, his job is to talk about the guy who raised himself from the dead. That's not a very high money-making job back in the day. but he used his resilient nature to raise money, to recruit men and women, to go and walk. There are estimates that Paul would have walked on average 20 miles a day to go preach the gospel. This man was relentless. And once he got turned off of murdering Christians and turned on to advancing the gospel, Jesus set that resilient nature on max. And he just went and went. The guy never stopped. He was whipped, beaten, stoned, thrown out of cities, shipwrecked multiple times. I mean, the guy was beaten to a pulp, but he never stopped. Why? Because he had a resilient nature that Jesus wanted to redeem. And he did. And he set it free on preaching the gospel. Number three, his brilliant mind. He had this amazingly brilliant mind to understand the social system, to learn where people were moving and how they were housing each other so that he could go after Christians and root them out at the deepest level. But God took that mind. Jesus renewed and redeemed that mind so that he became one of the most prolific writers ever. There are most pastors and theologians who really struggle to understand Romans. He wrote it. He sat down one day and was like, you know what? I think I'm going to put some theology to paper. And just started writing and wrote Romans. And wrote the thing that fills more commentaries than you and I could probably ever read in a lifetime of people trying to understand exactly what he said. He redeemed his mind. And then lastly, he redeemed his singleness. You know, so often when I talk to people who are single, they see it as a punishment, that somehow God has abandoned them and has set them on this nature of just being punished again and again. But, you know, Paul never once saw himself as a second-class citizen because he was single, and nor should you. You're not. What the world saw as punishment, Paul saw as an opportunity to fuel his whole life into the gospel. He gave himself fully and freely to the gospel, and Jesus redeemed it in a very big way because for so often, or so many times as you read throughout the scriptures, if you could just imagine a wife and children with Paul as he's being beaten like this. I mean, that would be a horrible way to live. Yet God used it, God redeemed it, God changed it. One of the things that it reminds me is nobody is beyond God's grace. Nobody's story is beyond God's saving power. No one is beyond what God wants to do because of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus through the power of the Spirit through you. No one's story is too far gone. No one's life is too far left in the past. No one is so far off the rails that God can't do anything about it. God can step into any circumstance, under any conditions, into any story, and make change. He can do it when he wants to do it, however he wants to do it. And so often in our lives we think, well, you know, I've blown it so bad. I've done so many things in my life that I just can't get beyond this. And one of the things I love about the story of Saul is it's a story of love and grace. It's a story of a God who will pursue an individual with grace and say, your story is not over yet because I say it's not over yet. Your story isn't garbage. Your life isn't going to be written this way. I want it to be written this way. And so often in my life, I get the opportunity to see people's lives change. It's one of those things that I was talking with our staff earlier this week, and we were just talking about life changing. It was really cool because, you know, we're old enough now as a church where we have stories, and it was one of those things where I was talking very theoretically about lives. Like, oh, you know, when someone is before they encounter Christ and then after encounter Christ, and this is kind of what it looks like, and then this is kind of what it looks like. And then over time, those theoretical stories became names. And we started sharing stories. Well, what about that? You remember that? Remember this part? I remember when we met them. Oh man, I'm not going to share any of those stories. You're welcome. But is it? Oh man, remember when we met them? That was rough. And then they met Jesus, and man, look at them now. Remember this person? You remember what they came? You remember that story? Man, that was a horrible story. Look at that. You see what Jesus did, and to see to step back and see lives changed and stories renewed and people's past become just a story. Because listen, everything in your past at some point in the future will just become one sentence of your story. It's just going to become a couple words. Oh yeah, then I had a rough season in college. That's going to be how you describe years of your life. Yeah, my 20s weren't great. That's going to be how you talk about a decade. But how you step back and talk about a life, about how God has transformed, how God has renewed, that is something entirely different. And so I guess more than anything, my encouragement to you would be don't give up, because Jesus hasn't given up on you. Don't give up on the prayers that you've been praying. Don't give up on that story, that faith story that you're trying to pursue with Jesus that you just haven't quite seen it yet. Don't give up. Don't give up on that friend. Don't give up on that family member who you're like, man, I don't think anyone can redeem that story, because Jesus can. You may not be able to, but Jesus can. Don't give up. Don't give up.